If you'd like to receive this podcast early and without ads, consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Listeners to this show can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience and early access, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, and an invitation to join the DSR Slack community. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code NOJOKE to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code NOJOKE. And thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. In recent days, a trend has become visible in a number of red states. GOP legislatures are advancing bills that place onerous new kinds of restrictions on public or school libraries. This has happened in Idaho, Alabama, Georgia, and others, and the target of some of these proposals, surprise, surprise, is LGBTQ content. Emily Drabinski grew up in Idaho. She's also openly gay, and she is now the president of the American Library Association, which means she's battling the book banners targeting LGBTQ materials in states like her own. So we invited her on the show to discuss this new trend. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks, Greg. I'm delighted to be here.
First, let's talk about what some of these proposals do. In Idaho, where you grew up, the bill passed by both chambers in the GOP legislature would allow lawsuits against public and school libraries that make material available that's deemed, quote unquote, harmful to minors. You guys argue that this relies on a definition of harmful to minors in the state code that includes any act of homosexuality. Can you elaborate on that?
I think what we're seeing in Idaho and across the country are systematic attempts to undermine the authority and agency of trained professional library workers to select materials on behalf of their publics. And that is how I see this. The angle that we see people taking are definitely attacking books by LGBTQ plus writers or writers of color. And it's no mistake, I think, that the attempts to ban books happen alongside attempts to restrict rights and access to opportunity in other ways.
How do these bills actually go after LGBTQ materials?
I think there is, what we're seeing is a definition of LGBTQ plus stories as definitionally inappropriate for minors, which is challenging for those of us who grew up as LGBTQ plus people. To see that our stories are criminalized in these ways is devastating and shocking, really, in 2024. So the attacks on the books are attacks on us.
And attacks on the American Library Association are heating up on the right big time. In Georgia, a bill passed one legislative chamber that would force all public and school libraries to refuse funding from and cut ties with the ALA. Something similar moved forward in Alabama, and right-wing lawmakers in numerous states have pushed for their state's libraries to cut ties with the group. Where did this all come from? What's the genesis of it?
You know, we've been fighting on the front lines of the organized censorship movement since 2021, when we began to see numbers of banned and censored books skyrocket, doubling year over year. This year, we saw a record number again of individual titles targeted for censorship at American libraries in all kinds of communities and in every state in the union is facing these kinds of issues. And I think as an association that is committed to equitable access to information for everyone, we don't fall outside of the assaults on the right to read.
There is something about the way you guys are fighting back against this stuff that I want to talk about. And you kind of hinted at it there. What's interesting about what the ALA is doing is that the group is explicitly declaring that there is a real imperative to diversify public library collections in both public and school libraries. You're saying this explicitly, as opposed to approaching these culture wars in a kind of defensive crouch, as some Democrats do. Can you explain why there's a need for this?
The story of what stories get to be told in American society is a long one, right? It didn't start in 2021 with these attacks. And as librarians, one of the things that makes us sort of uniquely positioned to understand what's happening in America right now is that we see everybody walk through our doors, all kinds of people, regardless of means, identity, political beliefs, religious beliefs. Everybody is welcome in a library and everybody comes in. And that means that we see when there are gaps in our collections and gaps in our service to particular parts of the community. And for decades now, the association has been committed to expanding access to the stories that have traditionally been left out of the historical record and out of the public record. And I'm really proud of that. I'm proud of that coming from the association for sure.
It seems almost as if what's at issue here is what the public space is. They want to place limits on what's acceptable in that space. And I think you guys, if I understand the argument correctly, are expressly saying we need a broader definition of what's acceptable in the public space.
Yeah, I mean, I think we think of public space as for the public, and that public includes everyone. And that's a core commitment of American libraries. It's a core commitment of American library workers. We are, in some ways, the only people left to defend access to public space, particularly interior public space. So when I think about this, I think about what are the public spaces that we have left after decades of sort of the narrowing of what counts as a public good and the sort of collapse of public access to public institutions. And we've got parks, which are outdoor space, and we've got libraries. So the library is really the last public space in most communities where anybody can walk in, go to the bathroom, get a drink of water, sit down and read, meet people who aren't like you, take your kids somewhere to learn how to read, access broadband internet. I mean, the list goes on and on of the things that people can access in their libraries. And having a space, and in some ways, I think just the fact that it's well lit and cool in the summer and warm in the winter is one of the things that make it, you know, one of the best things about American libraries. And expanding access to comfort and access is sort of what we care about.
Let's talk a little bit about the impact of some of these proposals. I think people miss something essential about them. They're less about responding to an actual problem than they are about summoning into existence a certain kind of fear and anger in parents, right? The public debates over these bills tell parents that they should be suspicious and fearful that shadowy enemies are lurking in public and school libraries who are out to indoctrinate kids, even though there's no basis for this. The manufacturing of fear and loathing strikes me as the point. Does that seem right to you? And what impact is that having in libraries across the country?
It's befuddling, right? Anyone who's worked in libraries, and I've worked in libraries for more than two decades, or anyone who uses a public library or a school library, the sort of story that's being told about them is very foreign. It doesn't make any sense, right? I live in Brooklyn, New York. My branch is the Windsor Terrace branch. I walk in usually on Saturdays and take a look at what the new books are that have come in. And every time I go in, there's a group of children talking together around a computer, around a book. There are people doing homework, people accessing the internet. You walk into a library, and I don't think it's possible to be against it. Right? Libraries are good places that provide access to information for everyone. And when you walk into one, it's like a lively, exciting, interesting place. And I think, you know, that's the story that's really important to get out here, out in the public. And I think the vast majority of Americans believe that about their libraries. Survey after survey demonstrates that people trust their local librarian and trust the institution. And so efforts to undermine it, I think that's aligned with other kinds of efforts to undermine public institutions, public education, public hospitals. We can think of a long list.
Yes, the question of trust strikes me as important. The idea here with these attacks seems to be to persuade parents that librarians and other educators don't have the best interests of kids at heart, that they have actively malevolent intentions as part of a kind of broader effort to get parents to lose faith in the professionalism of public institutions like libraries and public schools, right? I mean, the impact of this is to make librarians and school officials feel like they're perpetually on thin ice and to be kind of guarded about everything they say. Is that happening out there?
Yeah, you know, as American Library Association, my job is sort of to travel the country and talk to librarians in all parts of the country about what they're facing. And what I hear is an intense amount of anxiety, an intense amount of anger and frustration. These are public service workers, people who are committed to expanding access to the stuff of a human imagination for children, adults across the lifespan. And to wake up and see yourself targeted for exactly the opposite of what it is you're doing, right? I return to this number a lot from the joint report from the American Association of School Librarians and the Human Rights Campaign. And they asked trans and gender expansive youth if they felt safe at school. And a big chunk of them, of course, a majority said that they, on any given day, they don't feel safe at school. 90% reported feeling safe in the school library. So we know that the school library gives people access, not just to books, but to a place where they can be who they are and be themselves, and to have people turn around and attack that fundamentally good thing that school librarians are doing every day for their students, it's heartbreaking.
I want to give you a chance to respond to what some of these Republicans are saying. I think some of them tried to seize on this tweet of yours where you described yourself as a Marxist lesbian, but I read that as a description of your theoretical bent, not your political inclinations. And I'm a bit surprised by the outcry over this, particularly since it doesn't seem directly relevant in any way to the ALA. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I wish it was just an attack on the tweet. I think it's an attack on me as a person and on people who think what I think and are the kind of person that I am, you know, but I'm not a politician. I'm a career librarian. I've spent the last 23 years connecting people to the resources necessary so that they can live full and expansive and flourishing lives. And to be sort of targeted for something that absolutely has, you know, ALA is a huge organization. It has 48,000 members. Each of those members is a full, whole person that brings everything that they are to the profession and to the field. And, you know, we aren't being political here. The politics have been brought to us.
Right. And it just seems clear to me that the seizing on a tweet like that is about what we discussed earlier, which is an effort to create the impression that there are all these things to fear out there.
I mean, I was in a library over Christmas, right, with my family. And in that library in Lake Tahoe, in the Sierra Nevada, I went in because I needed to upload something to the internet, and that was the only broadband internet access I could find. When I was leaving, I turned to look to my right, and there was a shelf full of snowshoes that you could check out, that you could use to walk around in the snow, in the trails outside of the library. That just has nothing to do with politics, and it has everything to do with meeting the needs of a particular community.
I want to try to go big picture for a second here. Obviously, the right, and particularly the religious right, has targeted what they deem quote-unquote heretical materials in schools for many decades. But in the last few years, we've seen a certain kind of MAGA rage infused into these efforts. Moms for Liberty, for instance, which is probably the most prominent group pushing all this stuff. It gets constant fawning attention in the mainstream media, targeting books and teachers all over the country, trying to get teachers fired for assigning the wrong book and so forth. This group associates itself pretty heavily with Donald Trump and MAGA, and you have politicians like Ron DeSantis trying and fortunately failing to run for president on a fusion of a kind of MAGA and anti-LGBTQ politics. So is what we're seeing now something different from previous decades? Is there like a more virulent quality to it, a more dangerous and angry quality?
Absolutely. And I think that's undeniable. Just as people have always challenged books and music and video games and, you know, the whole long list of cultural touchstones that people sort of target. And, you know, that's always happening. And libraries always have processes and procedures in place for people who have concerns about materials in the collection. And I don't think that people remember that all the time, that like there are authentic reasons a person might have a concern about a book, and libraries are very open and very responsive and interested in talking with members of their community about how to make the library better. And I think, you know, it's correct for us to demand more of our public institutions. But that's not what we see happening here. This is an organized pressure campaign. That is often you'll have people from totally outside the community filing the challenges. I think a lot about a story of Kimber Glidden, who was a librarian out in Boundary County, Idaho, who faced one of these challenges in her library. And people showed up with a list of 500 books that they wanted removed from her library collection. They were demanding that she get these books off the shelves. How many of those books do you think were in the public library in Boundary County? Goose egg, zero. Right. And it So we know that the bans don't have anything actually to do with what's actually happening in an American public library. And the impact of that is really intense, right? So for Kimber, she faced people who would follow her and her staff home from their library. She had people park outside of her home with guns threatening her life. It's not a small thing. And Kimber eventually left the library. She couldn't handle that kind of threat of violence and has been struggling to find a position in the library ever since. And, you know, that's, for me, what ends up happening is that you lose high quality, professionally trained librarians committed to their communities. They, you know, it's a big ask to ask us to keep working through all of this. And I think of that as part of the end game here, that it isn't just about removing the books, but it's about removing professionally trained librarians. And then in some cases, it feels almost to me like it's about removing the library from a community altogether. And if you've ever brought your kid to a story time so they could hear a story with other kids in the room, I hope that strikes your listeners as absurd and unacceptable and something that we really need to push back against right now.
Your point about there being processes in place already seems key. Just to sort of repeat this again, what they're trying to do is create the impression that there aren't such processes.
Also, like, I think people sometimes, if you don't work in a library, you forget that that it takes a lot of work to make a library go, right? So think about this. In 2003, I think the 95% of American public library collections were physical materials. By 2016, that number was totally changed. And now collections are 55% digital. So how did that happen? How did we move from all the books are print to all the books are digital? It didn't just happen by magic. It didn't happen overnight. It happened because library workers like me and like the people I represent at the American Library Association worked to make that happen. We transitioned to the new context of information and how people wanted to receive it. We worked hard to meet people where they were with reading materials. Like, we're focused on solving problems, right? And to be sort of become part of this maelstrom that would prevent us from doing that work. And it's like, it's a lot. Like, because there's also the other problem of people who work in libraries not getting fairly compensated for that work and all of the problems that happen, you know, with underpaid public sector workers. We're asking them to carry like a pretty heavy load here to be sort of the last public institution that can meet the needs of people in communities with a fraying social safety net. And now we're hearing these stories told about us that just simply don't align with any reality that I've ever seen. Libraries use professional review tools to select materials for their libraries, and they might serve people in your community that you don't even know are there. Right? That's why we're there. We're there to make sure that everybody, not just you and the people that you know, have what they need for a full and flourishing human life.
You mentioned earlier an example of a librarian who was hounded by this kind of anger. What happens in these communities when this kind of MAGA rage comes onto the scene?
When these pressure campaigns happen, it can be really devastating. And I talk to a lot of librarians who are in exactly this kind of situation where they become a sort of organizing point for forces in their small towns and communities all over the country. And it tears the community apart. It turns people against each other. It turns people against the library. In a lot of places, the kind of only good thing going, right, which is your public library, especially in small and rural communities. And, you know, the library is a place that should be about uniting everyone. You know, and to have that turned into a way of dividing people against each other in communities where we really need to be pulling together. We've got real problems to face as a country and real issues that we need to come together and solve. And this just creates more of them.
This kind of division and hatred and anger is, I think, a feature of what they're trying to accomplish. It's not an accidental or incidental product of it. Well, Emily Drabinsky, thank you so much for coming on with us today.
It's a delight to talk with you. And I can just, one last thing, it's important that everybody use their libraries. So I want to make sure that I get that in there, that when we look at which public institutions have withstood this sort of pressure over time, it's the ones that everybody uses, right? If we're all in, that's the best way to save the American public library. So if you don't have a library card, go get one. If you have one, please use it. And I'll see you at the library.
Emily, thanks so much.
You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.